Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman, and Dr. Kate. And I'm very excited about our show tonight. We'll get around to introducing our guest here in just a moment. One of them at least is already on with us. Red, are you with us yet? Well, perhaps he's not. He may be muted. I'm going to go ahead and open us in prayer and then introduce our guest. Father God, we just... We come to you tonight and ask that your spirit fill us and go before us in this show. And we pray that what we do here pleases you and that it glorifies you. And we pray that you would lead us in this battle, that we are facing a government who is abusing their power. As a country, we realize that much of this country has turned its back on you. And we recognize that this country is under judgment, and we're trying to turn that around, Father. And we want to be on the front lines of that battle to direct people toward you. And we're looking for solutions. And we pray, Father, that you would show us the right solutions, and you would keep us from going down paths that are not where you want us to be. We just pray that you bless our listeners tonight, open their hearts and minds, and be with our guests, both Stephen and John, and just guide our words and our thoughts tonight. In the name of your Son, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Red, are you on with us now?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
I think you got unmuted.
Yeah.
Well, Red, our first guest is on with us. I'm just going to go ahead and launch right in, so please feel free to jump in whenever you take a notion, okay?
I'll be quiet.
You don't have to be quiet. You don't have to be quiet. Well, our first guest, I'm going to call him my friend because I feel like I've gotten to know him of late and trust his wisdom and trust his knowledge and he's been through the mill. He's paid the price for some of us to some extent. He's stuck his neck out there and has felt the heat. And Stephen Hance was one of the Montana Freemen, and I know Red, you've known him for a number of years, and I'm pleased to be able to say that I know him. I'm proud to know him. He's going to tell us a little bit about his story tonight, but he's also going to share some ideas about some ways that we might go about making a difference and trying to turn things around in this country. Stephen Hance, you have the floor, sir. Tell the folks about yourself.
Well, that's a sordid tale. Correct your... missing information. Red and I have never met. I'm reasonably sure that he knew some of my friends in Montana, Leroy Michael Schweitzer, who died in prison a couple of years ago. Leroy and I became very close, almost like brothers. We spent over a year in the hole together. And had daily fellowship, communication, and we became very close. So his passing was extremely difficult for me, but I did not know Red at all, except by his reputation. I'm not sure where exactly you want me to start, how much of what story you want to get into, so if you don't mind my kicking the ball back into your side of the court and let you become the director, if you don't mind.
Well, I'm sure that there's a number of people who have heard of the Montana Freeman. They know that, you know, obviously they're from Montana. That may be all they know about the Montana Freeman. So I'm not looking to spend 2 hours tonight telling that story, because I think there's some other things we want to get into, and hopefully John will join us eventually in this conversation. If you're out there, John, you'll need to hit a one to just let Dr. Kate know that you'd like a live mic when the time comes. In the meantime, you can stay muted if you choose to, because we'll get to that in a little bit. But most people, I mean, you know, I just got through reading Pat Shannon's book, The Montana Freeman, and, you know, frankly, I have some recall back in 1996, but I think most of us were still wrapped up in our red, white, and blue fever and listening to the media and not recognizing how much we were being lied to. You know, maybe just a little bit of background from the beginning of the inception about what the Freeman were about and what they were trying to accomplish would be a good place to start before we get into all of the government abuse and how that came down. I'd like to get there eventually, but to start with, give us a little background on what the Freeman were about, what the classes they had were, and who the players were.
All right. I can't speak authoritatively to that, the origins of the Freeman, because I wasn't there. My sons and I ended up having to go there under duress. I had heard of Leroy Schweitzer and what he was doing. I'd seen the I believe it was Dateline story on where Dan Patrick arrested the trespassers from, I believe it was one of the network TV stations, went out there to do an interview on these guys, or with these guys. They showed up unannounced. They crossed no trespassing signs, and Dan arrested them and confiscated their camera equipment as evidence and ran them off the property. And one of the cameramen made it. Was able to keep his camera. I'm not sure the details of how that happened, because I witnessed Dan taking the camera from him and running him off the property. Anyway, I've heard of him, and I wanted to find out what they knew. So friends of mine here in Charlotte, North Carolina area, had planned to go. Three of us were going as representatives of this study group here. In the meantime, my sons and I got into a very volatile situation with the right to travel issue, and we were losing that battle. So we ended up leaving, we ended up leaving here under duress, warrants for our arrest for this traffic, freedom of travel issue. And we decided to go on up 2 weeks early before the scheduled seminar and seek asylum. I talked to Leroy on the phone before we left, and he said, "Well, you can come, But as far as asylum is concerned, that's up to the township. The people will have to meet you and interview you and, you know, take a vote. So we went up there under with no promise of anything good coming from it. But long story short, we got there exactly 2 weeks before the feds scheduled raid occurred, and that was in March 25th, 26th of 1996. We were there for the 81-day standoff with all of the FBI, state troopers, county sheriff's deputies all surrounding us. If you can call setting up a perimeter around 2,500 acres is surrounding you. But with regard to the origins of the Montana Freemen, I don't believe they were ever called that until the media blitz hit several weeks into the standoff. They were not called anything before that. There were five or six, maybe seven of the guys had gone to one of the local or regional banks with coffee cigars, container size, a box full of gold coins. It was about $80,000 worth, and they were going to make a deposit. Of course, they didn't really care about making a deposit. They were more interested in making a point. But they were arrested for trying to deposit gold coins into a bank, and they became known as the Montana Seven. From that, I'm sure, is where the Montana Freemen developed. But the point of their origin was that these men had come together. All of them had been abused by the system. Their rights had been violated in one way or another. Leroy had lost about $1 million worth of property, land, his home, several crop duster airplanes that he had. That was his business. Dan Peterson had been accosted in different ways. He was a brilliant mechanic, engineer, designer. He had developed a carburetor that would get between 80 and 150 miles per gallon. And, of course, they couldn't have that, so that was confiscated from Dan. Rodney Owen Skirdall, the bear they called him, was a Marine of highly decorated. He was actually serving at one point in his career as presidential detail guarding Camp David. I don't remember how Rodney got involved other than just his knowledge of the law. When I met him, he was one of the preeminent, probably the most knowledgeable scholar with regard to the Montana statutes. He knew them forwards and backwards. Leroy, of course, was extremely knowledgeable in UCC. Dan was notary and knew the notary, the history and the lawful strength of the office of a notary. Anyway, the long story short, I said that before, and you'll find that my stories don't usually get very short. The Clark Ranches is where we were located. Prior to that, they had been, Leroy and Dan and Rod had been staying at Rod's cabin several miles away. and things got a little bit heated with them, because when they started their fight with the corporatocracy, they kept going into court and being denied even a hearing. And so they were complaining before one of the judges one day, and the judge said, if you don't like our courts, why don't you start your own? And they decided that was probably the word of the Lord, and that's what they did. And they set out to do exactly that, and they determined from their study of the Constitution of Montana and the Montana statutes over the years how to go about it, and they determined from all of their studies that the beginning of the government is the tenship, which is the ancient origin of the word township, where the 10 contiguous landowners, families, would combine together for their own, for their mutual defense, to help each other, to be good neighbors to one another. And so from the 10-ship concept came the township that we know today. And, of course, every county in every state is comprised of various townships. The townships form the counties form the states. And the states, of course, are the countries. That's a side note. Everybody talks about this country being in trouble, and that is a misnomer, because the United States of America is not a country. It's a federation of independent countries. But that's another story. You let me know if I get off track here, Terry. I'm trying to get
you. You're doing good. You're doing good. They formed this township, and I guess that was kind of the first thing that raised the flag that the authorities didn't like, because they knew that what they were doing could actually have a positive effect and give them a certain amount of authority, and that may have been the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, as far as Big Brother not being able to tolerate these people actually taking a sovereign stand. Is that kind of accurate?
It is, but not exactly. In fact, you said a mouthful there. The township was how they started, and they thought they were starting correctly. Only a couple of years ago, I determined somewhat serendipitously that was actually, as you say, the straw that broke the camel's back, but it was also the fundamental error that they made, which made it impossible for them to ever succeed long term. I'll tell you why in a minute. First of all, the court itself, I believe, was the real danger to the system, because most people don't understand that in this federation, as well as in the various countries in this federation, there is no functioning or a very limited functioning judicial branch of government. At the federal level, it's non-existent. Now, that's really not true. There are some Article III courts that function according to their constitutional mandate, but the U.S. district courts are totally fraudulent. They have absolutely no authority anywhere in the various states. And that's the court system that 99% of the people in the American Federation come in contact with when they are contacted by the federal government. The forts, they're not judicial. They are administrative tribunals, and they have absolutely no judicial authority whatsoever. In the various states, the state courts are all co-opted as well. They technically, the county courts are still basically common law constitutional tribunals or courts, but the court that most people engage the state government with, or the local governments with, is a superior court, and they've all been co-opted and corporatized and basically taken over by a corporatocracy, just like the state governments have, the county governments have, the city governments have, right down to, you know, the school districts that have been co-opted and taken over by private interests. So the court that these men established was a real court of common law jurisdiction, original jurisdiction, in the organic state of Montana. And that was the real problem, because from that little court of, I don't know how many there were, seven or eight men before we got there, that little court issued decrees, official decrees, under court seal to the state legislature of Montana, and the legislators in Montana, in Helena, obeyed the orders that were given to them from the highest court in the land. So that was what really was the scare factor. And then on top of that, they had in excess of $6 trillion worth of perfected private securities, primarily gained against the corporatocracy itself, the corporation called the United States. And that was a real scare factor. So now to what I alluded to early on. Those two things were serious, serious problems for the corporate government, because it was, it represented a financial threat, because the UCC is universal, it's recognized throughout the world, and there were foreign interests buying those private securities and putting at risk the corporate government. So there was a financial threat, and there was a threat of the common law being reestablished, because all it takes is for the people to insist on the common law being established, and it cannot be unestablished. It can only be hidden and controverted and taken from the people by threat, duress, and coercion, or by deception. Primarily, it's deception. Now, those were big threats, but I believe what happened at some point along the way, the think tanks in D.C., being much smarter than me, identified the core problem. And the core problem with Justice Township was that it was, sorry, the corporate town, I mean, the Justice Township was flawed at its inception, because they created a new township on land that was already within the boundaries of an existing lawfully created township. And that is something you cannot do. That is technically an act of war. It is an insurrection, technically and actually. And so the government was actually right in attacking them on that basis, but of course they never came out and told everybody what the basis of it all was. But in the situation that we find ourselves in since 1865 is that we're under an occupational situation under the Lieber Code, which is military law, and insurrection cannot be tolerated. It won't be tolerated. And honestly, it shouldn't be tolerated. If they had gone to their neighbors, you know, in a peaceful attitude and tried to use persuasion, they might have had the ability to get all of the landowners in that township to go along with them. And if they had done that, there would have been some real significant change, in my opinion. What they did, however, was they muscled in on the public lands and started doing quiet title claims against, originally they picked out 100,000 acres contiguous to the Clark Ranches and claimed it, and some of that land was being leased by their neighbors, and the neighbors got offended because they didn't want to pay this bunch of rowdy guys what they had been paying the federal government. So they got they created animosity among their neighbors, and there was actually at one point before my sons and I arrived, the neighbors had organized a militaristic invasion of Justice Township. They were going to go in with the county sheriff and just attack them. And for some reason, they decided not to do that at the last minute. I don't know if it was intelligence that was gathered by somebody in the community, and they found out how heavily armed the people of Justice Township were, and they realized that they might not stand a chance, but they decided to stand down anyway.
Well, the interesting thing there is, though, that it doesn't seem like the federal government would have had jurisdiction, but rather the state government would have had jurisdiction. So what brought the feds in?
Well, the feds take jurisdiction where it doesn't exist every day. That's their modus operandi. Furthermore, under the Lieber Code, which is military law, the federal government, through the military, does take jurisdiction whenever there's an insurrection. And I'm sorry, I haven't coughed all day. Anyway, the feds, as you know, presume authority where it doesn't exist and never could exist, and that's based on a number of false presumptions, but it's primarily based on the Lieber Code and the fraud that came out of the so-called Civil War. That war has never ended. There was never a treaty, and there was never actually a declaration of war, to my knowledge. I may be wrong about that. I'm no historian. But in 1865, there was a cessation of hostilities, and the southern states went back into their original organic governing status, and that is proven clearly by the passage of the 14th Amendment, which is currently called the 13th Amendment. But the 14th Amendment, which is the anti-slavery amendment, all of the southern states, or enough of the southern states, including North Carolina, voted to ratify that amendment. But when the 15th Amendment was presented, which is currently called the 14th Amendment, all of a sudden states said no, not just no, but hell no. We just lost thousands of soldiers fighting a war over this very concept, the concept being a nationalization of the Federation. The Federalists have wanted a national government from the beginning, and that's what they have attempted to do by coercion and deception. And that's why I recoil at the use of the term our country. My country is Texas because that's where I was born and raised, but it's also North Carolina because that's where I live, and it's where many of my relatives came from two generations back. So the federation that my countries and the other countries of America created is not a country. It's a federation. And we have been systemically and systematically programmed to think of the United States federal zone as our country. It is not our country. And we need to learn to change our thinking so that we are more precise in what we actually think, and that way we can be more precise in what we actually say. So maybe I'm drifting and rambling, and I should stop and let you get me back on track.
Well, trying to get down to, you know, these folks were holding classes, law classes. They were teaching people. They obviously took on some judges and officials in a way that no one had done that in a long time, and ended up filing liens on property up to $17 trillion, is what I understand, and that many people looked at those and thought that they had done it through proper procedures, and that they had broken no real law other than this insurrection of creation of a township, as you mentioned. But in general, you know, people were feeling like that this was just a pure government abuse situation. And there was also this strange event of this Judge Burns allowing them to actually form a grand jury, and then I don't know what happens to the story after that. But were you there when this Burns had them go in and basically dismiss the charges against themselves?
I'm not sure. That sounds like a convolution of what actually happened. I was not there. There was, you know, as I said, 81 days from the time that Leroy and Dan were were assaulted and kidnapped off of the ranch. They were taken directly to the tiny little post office in Brissette, about 5 miles away, and that's where they had a bevy of reporters and cameras to show Leroy and Dan being arrested on the post office property, and that way they were able to make a pretense of jurisdiction, but they were not arrested there. They were kidnapped. They were assaulted and kidnapped by 14 federal agents on the Clark Ranch. One of them. It was Ralph Clark's ranch is where they were. But anyway, I lost my train of thought, Jerry. Sorry.
Well, do you have knowledge of where they
oh, James Burns.
This Burns let them conduct a hearing where Schweitzer was actually shown and had a placard there and everything as the Chief Justice?
If that happened, it was during the 81-day siege, and we had no knowledge of it.
Okay.
I had no knowledge of that. I know that during those first 81 days, there were numerous times that Leroy and Dan were taken into the courtroom, and they just beat the living daylights out of the judges, because they knew far more statutory law, case law. They knew more constitutional law. They knew more common law than any of the judges or prosecutors, and they just tore those people up. So they didn't make a whole lot of progress. And I don't think James Burns ever came onto the scene until after we all capitulated and walked off the ranch, thinking that we had a remedy in place. But that's another story. When we got into court the first time, James Burns was actually pulled out of retirement. He was known as the Patriot Buster, federal judge. He had a real reputation for busting up patriots who were taking constitutional positions and things like that. So they brought him out of retirement. But he tried to pull a fast one on us by showing up in court without the devil robes on. And he made a big show of the fact that he was there recognizing our justices, pointed out to us, he motioned to us that he was in the presence of our justices, and he said that he was not wearing the traditional black robes because that actually had an ecclesiastical origin. Of course, he didn't bother to tell them that it was the satanic ecclesiastical court that it came from. But he made a big show of recognizing us as justices and recognizing our right to common law. He recognized our right to have counsel from anyone that we wanted. And he gave indications that everything that Leroy and the Montana Freeman stood for long before I ever even met them was actually going to come to fruition, that the Constitutional Republic was going to be restored and that we were going back to a common law venue as it was in the beginning. It wasn't until the second or third trip to court that I saw through the whole thing and that this guy was just playing us for a bunch of country bumpkins. And it was in the second or third time we were in the courtroom, they brought us in without handcuffs, without body chains, no leg shackles, in our street clothes that we were arrested in. And we were sitting there about 9:30 in the morning. Burns comes out and starts telling his lumberjack stories again. And, you know, it was so obvious to me that he was just playing us. I decided to be as rude as I could, and I interrupted him, and I had to pretty well yell at him to get him to realize that I was being rude to him. And he finally looked at me and said, "What is it, young man?" And I said, "Look, I don't care about your cotton picking lumberjack stories. I don't care what you did with your brother when you were teenagers. I'm not interested in knowing any of your history. The issue here is venue and jurisdiction, and I don't care about sitting here and listening to any more of your stupid stories." And he said something the line of, "Well, I'm just trying to have a conversation with you." And I retorted something along the lines, "I'm not interested in having a conversation with you. Conversations, that's what I do with my friends or people that may become my friends. You're neither one, and I don't want to have a conversation with you." About that time, Dan Peterson stuck his hand out in front of me to shut me up. And he said, "Judge Burns, we are nonviolent people. We're peace. We're law-abiding people. And we'd like to post a peace bond with this court in the amount of $2.2 billion in private perfected securities." And when he said the word peace bond, it was like somebody shot Judge Burns with a beanbag. He jerked back, he folded up his papers and said, "Well, I think that's enough for today." He got up and left the court and never came back. So we're sitting there looking at each other and like, wow, that was potent. And, of course, because of that, it never left my mind that the issue, the mention of posting a peace bond shut them down. Now, we sat there for a long time, and after about 15, 20 minutes, the marshals were taken out of the room, and one of them came and made a big show of opening all of the doors at the back of the courthouse. And he went downstairs, just like I think three or four stairs down to the entrance of the courthouse, and he opened the doors to the street outside. So we were sitting there, and from where we were, we could look over our shoulders and see cars and people walking on the sidewalks right outside the court building, the courthouse. And that marshal who opened the doors left the room. And I'm looking around and seeing a completely empty courtroom. And I said to Russell Dane, I said, "Look, guys, they left the doors wide open. We can walk right out on the street and we'll be free." And they all looked at each other and looked back there and they said, "Yeah, it's just a setup. They're going to shoot us as soon as we walk out the door." I thought, well, that's probably it. So we sat there in an empty courtroom, totally able to free ourselves by walking out on the street. For about 30 minutes, maybe 35 minutes. And after about 35 minutes, one of the marshals came back in and said, "Well, are you guys ready to go?" And we looked at each other and said, go where?" And he shrugged his shoulders and said, "Well, back to jail, I guess." And we all shook our heads and said, "Yeah, I guess so." So we basically arrested ourselves and went back into their jurisdiction and their whole venue of our own volition. So that's what Judge Burns was there for. He was there to trick us. He was there to get us to make a mistake. And apparently we made several.
So what happened then?
We went back to jail. We were there for almost 2.5 years before they finally got through with their sham process and trial. Found everybody guilty except the ones that played the game. Everyone that took a plea or took the stand, like Edwin Clark, got up there and told everybody that he became a government witness against everybody else. His son did the same thing. So they were found not guilty. And
What happened to the liens that they filed?
Well, that's an interesting story in itself. There were, I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $13.5 billion worth of those liens were bought, and are, I don't know if they're still out in the marketplace today, but they were for a time. Leroy and the guys never got a dime from all of that. The people who came to him and said that they wanted to help him and that they could monetize those liens. Well, they did monetize them, but they kept all the money. When we had been in jail for, close to 2 years, Leroy and my sons and I and Rodney Owen, we formed a court in the jail, in the hole. Rodney was in the medical unit right next door to us. So we met almost every day with Rodney and spoke and passed notes through the steel door. But we set the court there. We appointed marshals on the outside. We held hearings, and we created paperwork to remove the cases into an Article III court in the District of Columbia Circuit. And we bonded the action with one of those liens. Leroy wrote UCC-3 assignment for $1 trillion, and we bonded our action with that UCC-3 assignment. It was a partial assignment. And we sent it off to the Freedom Center where our allies, Randy Carson, was supposed to send it off. He says he sent it off. I believe he did send it, but we were told that the marshals intercepted the package at the courthouse and took it to a different court. And when they got it, it was marked on the package to return to sender, but the package had been opened, and the $1 trillion UCC-3 partial assignment was not in the package. So we know that they stole it. Then we did the thing again. We altered a little bit. Leroy wrote another $1 trillion assignment. We put it in the package. We sent it off. And I don't remember what happened to the second package, but nothing ever came of it. But strangely enough, you may check your Google search the $2 trillion that Bill Clinton found mysteriously somewhere and was able to straighten out the federal budget for a while. That's where the $2 trillion came from.
Okay. So, was it the liens that they charged them with fraudulent kind of stuff on? Were they did that result in charges against people?
The fraudulent financial instruments was part of the charge, yes. And we had, or not we, but actually Leroy's, the public defender that was appointed for Leroy, I believe he actually tried to do his job because he had Walker Todd and Hartford Van Dyke were both present in court to testify. Walker Todd, as you know, was one of the counselors. I don't know if he was chief counsel for the Federal Reserve. I believe it was one of the Federal Reserve banks. But he was a very, very knowledgeable guy. And he was there to testify. He's also got affidavits that you've probably read, articles he's written about money. And both he and Hartford Van Dyke were going to testify that the warrants that Leroy wrote, that the liens that they had were all totally lawful and totally valid, as valid at least as a Federal Reserve note. But of course, they were forbidden to testify. I read the transcript where the attorneys warned Judge Kuhnauer that he was skating on very, very thin ice and forbidding exculpatory evidence from being presented to the jury. Kuhnauer said, we don't need any testimony about those bogus instruments. They're bogus because I say they're bogus, and that's all there is to it. So the answer to your question is yes.
So one of these guys is still in prison after all these years, right?
Well, not one. Dan Peterson served out his time, and he was walking out the gates of the prison in I think he's in Terre Haute. I'm not sure about that. No, that's where Russell is now. I'm not sure where Dan was, but he was at the outer gate, and the marshals walked up behind him and said, Dan Peterson, we have a warrant for your arrest. That was a total scam, and they charged him with new charges and ran him through another scam court and put him back in prison. So Daniel Peterson is still in prison. Rodney Owen is out. I think Richard Clark is out. I never got to know Richard. Russell Dean Landers, one of my best friends from that fiasco. He and his wife were from North Carolina. Russell was given 45 years, so he'll never get out of prison. If he ever comes close, they'll probably kill him. But I don't think there are any of the others that are still locked up.
Well, before we get off of this topic and move on to board of review, can you talk a little bit about the media cover-up?
Of what?
Well, they demonized these guys. They made them out to be something that they weren't. You know, they made it seem like they were, you know, up there holed up with weapons pointed at people, and that it just didn't strike me that that was the case, that these people were not criminals. They were not. These were wise men who understood the law and were trying to do something good for the people, and the media, you know, made them out to be some radical militia group that was a true threat to the nation or the people.
Right. Well, that's, you know, that's what they get paid for. And there's really, really not much more to be said about it. As I said earlier, the time I spent with Leroy, we became very close friends. The letters that we wrote before we got locked up, Leroy was in the hold the entire time. They never put anybody in the cell with Leroy because, you know, he just had a tendency of rubbing off on people and turning them into activists. We got, you know, as a group, we got a lot of people out of jail with the knowledge of the law that they had and things that I learned from Leroy. I was able to help two guys get out of jail instead of going to prison. But yeah, they were very, very devout men. They were not religious in the sense of the people that you and I have grown up with. You know, I'm not that kind of a guy either anymore. Mainly because it's, you know, it's fraudulent. But yeah, they were good, honest men. They were and still are, except Leroy, of course, has gone on.
Let me restate what you just said the way I understood what you just said and make sure that I did hear you correctly, okay?
Right.
These were men who knew the scripture and who knew Yahweh, who knew the Messiah, and followed that way of life, but they were not a participant in organized religion.
That is correct. And I had most of my letters that I got from Leroy when we were not locked up together. We wrote almost every day. But he never signed off on a letter without saying, without writing the words, Yeshua leads the way. One of the first letters I got from Leroy shortly after we were locked up, I was asking him questions and saying, because I was a neophyte back then, and I'll never forget what he wrote in response to my queries. He said, "Stephen, you have found the real church." And I thought, wow, have I? And over the years, that was 1996, and I've come to believe that those were extraordinarily true words. I've come to the conclusion. Yeshua, everybody quotes Yeshua saying, "Seek first the kingdom of heaven, and everything else will be added to you." And you say, "Okay, how do you seek the kingdom of heaven?" "Well, you go to church and pay your tithes." Well, no, you don't. The kingdom of heaven is about what? Paul wrote the words, "The kingdom of heaven is not meat and drink. It's righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Ghost." What is the first thing that the kingdom of heaven is about? Righteousness. What is righteousness? Ask a preacher. Righteousness means right standing with God. No, it doesn't. Righteousness means justice. Righteousness and justice are the identical same thing. The same word in both the Greek and the Chaldean language called Hebrew. Hebrew's the same word in both languages is translated as righteousness and other places as justice. Righteousness means exactly what it sounds like. It means protecting the rights, the inherent rights of other people. It has nothing to do with what most people think of as religion. It has to do with protecting the rights of others, people who are weak, people who are ignorant, people who haven't got the ability to defend themselves. That's what righteousness is, and that's what is the definition of a crime, is when someone invades and violates the rights of other people. And that's the reason we have government. It's the only reason we have governments. There is no valid government on earth if it does not protect the rights of the people. And that's why we do what we do, is we have to restore righteousness to government, or replace the government with a righteous one.
We had a person in our chat room ask about John Trockman.
Okay. Asking what?
Well, they said, how about John Trockman? And they said, that's one of the Freemen.
Well, no, it's not. He never was, to my knowledge. I'm not going to tell the story because my memories are not clear enough and sharp enough, so I'm not going to comment on things that Leroy and some of the others said to me about different people.
Stephen.
Yes.
Before we change topics, is there anything else you'd like to say about the Montana Freeman?
Well, I had been praying for several years for knowledge and wisdom with regard to the restoration of the constitutional republics, and I was led to Montana to find those answers, and I did. I found some good friends. I found a great deal of adversity. I think they're great men who did the best they could to try to help all of their American countrymen get free. And they need... We need boards of review so that we can get them out of prison, along with all the others that are there unlawfully.
Well, you've faced the beast and paid some time as a result, yet you're willing to pursue boards of review. So let's go there. Explain to the people what a board of review is and why you believe that that's what we need.
Well, as I said earlier, we were told after just a couple of days after we got locked up that the turncoat attorneys that my wife's family hired from Black Mountain, North Carolina, to come up there and you know, try to talk some sense into me and my boys. They were having drinks with the feds, including Timothy Healy, the traitor who came in and pretended to be a friend and wanting to help us or help the township. He was the leader of the group that accosted Leroy and Dan. But they were all drinking together, all the attorneys and all the so-called negotiators and the federal agents, and having a big party because, you know, they just made huge headlines all over the world. And one of them, the one from Louisiana, was heard to say what the Montana Freemen were doing with the courts is going to change the face of the courts in America for 100 years. In other words, the courts was the biggest threat to everything that they stood for, and that they stand for today, and it still is, because as I said earlier, there is no judicial branch of government functioning in any of these countries. A board of review has the power, when structured as I suggested, to create a common law court if it deems it necessary. But it's not really necessary because the express purpose and function of the boards of review is to bring individual officers of the corporate government into review. Their actions or lack of actions are complained about and investigated. They're given an opportunity to defend themselves. And if they fail to, then they're going to be convicted of what they're accused of doing or not doing. Has nothing to do with creating a new government. It has nothing to do with changing the government, except where the government structure has been co-opted by a corporatocracy. And the restoration of the organic law of the land is what we seek to do. These people who receive a public salary have an obligation to us as our servants. And when they step out of line and assume authority that they do not possess, they've broken the law. And all of them have done it. There may be a few exceptions, but I doubt that there will be very many. And so I believe, that a properly structured board of review has the power and the ability to bring these people to answer for their crimes and to remove them from office, and that's our objective.
You all right?
Did I answer your question, or have I created more confusion?
I was afraid my Skype, it got so quiet, I was afraid my Skype connection might have gone down on me. But, well, maybe you want to visit about Article 61 of the Magna Carta and then go from there.
Right. Article 61 has been referenced as the authorization or the creation, the origin of the grand jury, the common law grand jury in particular. When I read that assertion a while back, I went immediately to investigate it, and I found nothing vaguely resembling a grand jury in Article 61 of Magna Carta. I can see how the concept of the grand jury could have developed over time from what is found in the in that article of Magna Carta. But let me get my computer up here and read the pertinent part of the Article 61. Here it is. Quote, "They shall elect 25 barons of the kingdom, whom they will, who ought with all their power to observe, hold, and cause to be observed the peace and liberties which we have conceded to them, and by this our present charter confirmed to them in this manner, that if we or our justiciar or our bailiffs or any of our servants shall have done wrong in any way, pardon me, toward anyone, or shall have transgressed any of the articles of peace or security, and the wrong shall have been shown to four barons of the aforesaid 25 barons, let those four barons come to us or to our justiciar, if we are out of the kingdom, laying before us the transgression, and let them ask that we cause that transgression to be corrected without delay. And if we shall not have corrected the transgression, or if we shall be out of the kingdom, if our justiciar shall not have corrected it within a period of 40 days, counting from the time in which it has been shown to us, or to our justiciar, if we are out of the kingdom, the aforesaid four barons shall refer the matter to the remainder of the 25 barons, and let these 25 barons, with the whole community of the country, distress and injure us in every way they can. That is to say, by the seizure of our castles, lands, possessions, and in such other ways as they can, until it shall have been corrected according to their judgment, saving our person and that of our queen and children, etc. So, in other words, that's exactly what the people in Justice Township did. They put liens on all of the properties of these perverts in power. But you see, the Article 61 encompasses far more than just investigating to see if a crime may or may not have been committed. And that is all that a grand jury is capable of doing in any case. You cannot create a grand jury that has more power than to investigate to find out if maybe there's been a crime committed. And all they can do is make a suggestion to whoever the prosecuting power may be that something needs to be done about it.
If you need to go get a drink of water or something, we'd be glad to cover for a few minutes.
Well, I've actually been sipping on it as I go along here. I don't know what's happened to my throat today, but I'll try to get the words out without tearing your ears up. Anyway.
I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, I'm sorry that I'm having this ridiculous condition here. I know it's obnoxious to listen to. The grand jury, simply stated, has essentially no power whatsoever. And the reason is, there has to be a court, first of all, for a grand jury to even exist. The only way that a grand jury can be seated without a court is if the sheriff determines that a grand jury is needed for a certain purpose and function. And so sheriffs historically have the authority and power to seat a special grand jury. But that is, in essence, the sheriff creating a court from the community and seating the grand jury for a special purpose. Other than that, the only thing that resembles a grand jury in American jurisprudence is a coroner's inquest, where a coroner calls together a body of investigative powers to investigate suspicious deaths. And it may or may not include anybody from the community other than the coroner's office itself. In many jurisdictions, the coroner and the sheriff are basically the same thing. But the point is, you can't have a grand jury apart from a court. And the courts have all been co-opted. and so there's no realistic expectation of a remedy coming from any of the courts in the American states, certainly not at the federal level. So one of the things that's going around in the among the proponents of the grand jury is a quote from Justice Scalia in the Williams versus U.S. versus Williams back in 1992, where he said something to the effect that the grand jury is like a fourth branch of government and is separate from the government and comes directly from the people. And they jumped on that and said that that shows that the federal government, the Supreme Court, has recognized the people's right to create common law grand juries, which is absolutely not true. That's not what he said at all. But he did allude to the fact that the power of the people, the authority of the people at their own level to do anything that they deem necessary outside the bounds of the government structure is within their power and authority to do. That's the essence of the truth he was alluding to. And that's the fact, that is the basic fact of which I draw from with the creation of the boards of review. We the people are the actual foundational reservoir of authority in any location on earth. The people have been given the authority by the Creator. Genesis 1:28, and Elohim said, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion." If you do those things, you have dominion. And that's the original jurisdiction. That's also the original first trust where the usufructuary was established. So everything on the earth is here for our benefit. But other people are not here for us to invade and conquer and overwhelm, and we don't have the right to impose our will on other people. But we do have the right to have dominion over our own lives. And so governments, as the Declaration of Independence so eloquently stated, they are in existence for only one reason, and that is to protect the rights of the people that are inherent from the Creator. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that governments are instituted among men for their protection. And if the governments don't do their job, it's our right, it's our obligation to overthrow them, to alter them, to abolish them, do whatever we need to make the government work to protect our rights. The government doesn't exist to order us around and take our property. That's what the boards of review are for, to force the government officers to obey the law to which they're bound. They're bound by the laws. We're not. They can't write laws that bind us. In the very first Supreme Court of the United States of America, Chisholm versus Georgia, Justice Wilson, I think it was, wrote the opinion of the court, and he said, the only way that a freeman can be bound by human laws is if he binds himself. That, in a nutshell, is all anybody needs to know about government's relationship to people. They're not our rulers. We do not have rulers. They're our servants, and they're acting like rulers. As King Solomon wrote, there are four things in the earth that it can't stand. One of them was when a servant becomes a master. And that's what we have in the government, in the corporatocracies that exist in all the states and in the federal government. We've got a bunch of servants who have manipulated themselves into a position of power where they've turned the tables on us, and they've made us their servants. People have been dumbed down by the Diseducation Commission. They've been chemically lobotomized with the sodium fluoride in their drinking water, and we've been turned into a bunch of sterile, unthinking automatons. And that's what the boards of review is for, is to reverse that trend in America, to reverse the trend of the servants becoming masters, to put righteousness back in the government.
Well, when we did the Continental Congress, I had been told at that time by people like John Rowland and some others that effectively what that Continental Congress was a board review. The delegates had been elected in their local areas. It came together, with delegates and bylaws and, everything that was suitable for that. We also talked to parliamentarian about that, and they agreed that it would have been considered a border review. But the problem was that we didn't know at that time what the real authority and power of a border review was.
Right.
And then of course that whole body got undermined by its creator, which I don't want to get into, to pointing fingers on that, but basically the work of that group was, they attempted to take control of it by an individual instead of honoring the authority of the group. And
right.
At this point, it seems that a properly assembled border review in a state or a county could be very powerful, and in more ways than one. It could be an education arm in addition to providing remonstrances, which are reasons for petitions. But the advantage that I see, based on what I read in Article 61 of the Magna Carta and other examples, and what you have shared with me, it has the ability to proceed with enforcement of redress of a grievance as opposed to just petitioning for that redress or issuing a presentment or an indictment, which may or may not ever be prosecuted further. The Board of Review has the ability to proceed with that enforcement. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's the big difference. The Board of Review is the voice of the people directly. There's no campaigning. There's no political action. It has nothing to do with a steering committee for the party or the legislature. It has nothing to do with the government structure at all. It has to do with, did you violate your oath of office by doing this or this or this, or not doing this or that? It's very simple. We don't have to get into a lot of convoluted political arguments. Do you have the authority, which is what quorato means, by what authority do you put people on the streets in automobiles called cruisers and cruise the harbor, so to speak, looking for a way to increase tariffs, to create revenue? By what authority does a municipal corporation hire armed thugs to go into the public ways and highways and accost the people on the roads to get money from them? Where does your authority come from? These people are not employees of your corporation. So where do you get the authority to tell these guys to go out there and rob the people on the highways? You don't have that authority. We're not your puppets. We're not your servants. We're not out here to put money in your pockets. So where's your authority? That's the purpose of a board of review, to put these people back in their place. I get a little revved up.
So. Well, I know that you guys are working on a website. We've been watching the board and watching for somebody to put their hand up on the board. John, if you're out there, please do call in, or anyone that's got questions at this point, please feel free to call in and raise your hand. 347-838-9176 is our call-in number, and we are open for questions at this point. Red, you've been quiet for an hour and a half, and I'm saying this and giving you time to unmute if you have any comment or question at this point. I believe this would be a good time.
Well, I just unmuted my phone. I've enjoyed the hour and a half of quiet where I couldn't talk and be heard. Steve talking about the Montana Freeman, it brings back a lot of memories for me. Leroy Schweitzer got involved because he heard what I was teaching and what I was doing in Montana, and he got involved. Leroy was a very, very intelligent man. He was more intelligent than I, and within a year after he became involved, you know, he was way ahead of his teacher, you might say. And so there was just a lot of things that played into this, and one of the things that nobody wants to talk about, and this is just my idea, but I think that when you have a bunch of public servants that would like to be public masters, these people are usually mentally in the lower IQ community. And when they run into somebody, when they have somebody come along like Leroy and Peterson, of course, and Skirdall, people that are so much more intelligent, more capable of proper thought and such, they feel so threatened. These people with the low IQs, they would prefer to be able to use force to get their way and force their opinions. And so as I listened here, it brought back a lot of memories and a lot of sad things that happened. And, of course, I tried to get Skirdal and Leroy and Peterson. I tried to get these guys to listen because I really felt that I told them, I said, before you go out and do all these things, like putting these liens on people and such, on public servants, before you do that, we have to get the juries. We've got to get an education process going here where we can educate the people. And in the early 80s, we were getting there. We were getting it done. In 1979, the Internal Revenue Service put out a news release, and they were bragging about the fact that they had tried 12 IRS criminal prosecutions and won 11 of them. And, of course, they had gone back. The one they lost, they went back and recharged the individual and got him the second time around. So they were batting pretty much 100%. But in 1980, the IRS lost 4 out of 5 cases that they prosecuted in the federal courts in the state of Montana because we had enough people educated at that point to train juries, get trained jurors to say not guilty in these tax cases. I look back and now I understand what happened, and it's rather painful because, you know, coming from the grassroots like I did, and basically Leroy and Dan and all the rest of them were coming from the same part of society as I was. We found that we weren't near as smart as we would like to have been or should have been at that point. We were in over our heads, and we did not realize that the media is owned and controlled by basically by people who are dedicated Satanists, Luciferians, and such, and they got in on this thing back there in the early 80s and said, hey, we've got to stop these people because we can't you know, let these people, you know, find people not guilty of filing the income tax returns and all of that. And of course, I need to bring out the fact that it was in June of 1980 that the Montana Historians was an ad hoc group of farmers, ranchers, and small business people who started the research investigating the 16th Amendment ratification process. And, of course, that led to the publication of the book, The Law That Never Was, Volume 1, in 1985, because we accumulated over 17,000 certified documents. Now, I want to make sure that people don't you know, think that I went out and did all this. I didn't. The people that did all of this work were people that I had helped to educate and such, but at that time, I was burning the candle both ends and the middle at the same time, trying to get my fellow Americans alerted to the danger that we were facing in this country. But we just did not realize that our media was an evil force in this country. And the American people were gullible. They thought that the media was being honest and all of that. And we didn't realize. We should have taken the media on at that point, I guess, better than we did. But anyway, hindsight seems to work pretty well, and of course I have spent many, many hours and days trying to evaluate what has happened in the past, and I've come to some pretty strong conclusions that we did get in over our heads. We had some profound experiences in the state of Montana getting things done. But in 1988, when I ran for governor, the vote fraud in the primary election that year in particular, the vote fraud was so massive in the state of Montana. It was perpetrated. It was encouraged. It was, you know, the media. They stepped into the picture, and they were going to pick the candidates in our elections and such, and we just did not realize that people could do such things as that. And so I'm glad we've got to had Steve on the program tonight. I got to quit my rambling here because I could go on all night too, it's tough having to look back and see where we weren't up to speed on a lot of things. And you know, I was correct in a lot of things in that I thought that Leroy and the fellows were going too fast. Because I wasn't in enough brain to keep up with Leroy, I'll tell you that. The man had a fabulous, fabulous brain, and that is what was the target of the outlaws, the gangsters that had gotten control of our government. And they just could not tolerate having a group of people out there that were way ahead of them on brain power. They couldn't have that. They had the media. The media was in their corner. The media kept the people in the dark about what was happening. They didn't listen to me. They listened to the media. And so I better quit, because this is something that a person cannot explain in a matter of an hour or 2 hours. There's more to it than that, but I think I hope that I've hit a couple of high spots, perhaps, to help people understand what happened. Back to you, Terry.
Well, thank you, Red. I'm sure that Stephen thanks you, too, because it gave him his throat an opportunity to have a bit of a rest. If anyone wants to ask a question and you've called in, you have to hit a 1 on your phone in order to raise your hand so that our wonderful producer, Dr. Kate, who is watching the switchboard, will know that you want to ask a question or a comment. Stephen, you've had a little time now to rest your voice there, and maybe Red might have spurred some thought. We've got about 20 minutes left here. Really want to go wherever you'd like to take the show at this point.
Well, Greg, thank you, Terry, and thank you, Red. One of the last things that Red said about Leroy, he might get a chuckle out of that. A story that Leroy told me directly, in the early days of before the Montana Freemen got together, before they formed their township, when they were, Leroy was living in the attic of Rod's, I think it was Rod's cabin, and the feds were looking for him. And he had to hide out in those early days, and for I think it was like a year and a half, 2 years, he was living in the attic and going by the name of Dave, so that nobody would catch on that who they were talking about. So it was we were probably 2 months into the siege when I had gotten to know the people there on the ranches well enough, and I asked Ralph one day, I said, "Ralph, who the heck is Dave? You guys keep talking about Dave. I've never met Dave. Who the heck is Dave?" And they looked around furtively, and he decided, I guess, that I'd been there long enough to know who Dave was. So he said, "Well, Dave, that's a name we give Leroy, so nobody knows who we're talking about." But Leroy told me during that time that he was hiding out in the attic, all he ever did was read, study, pray, eat, and sleep. And he said, people often ask me how I'm able to figure all these things out. And the truth is, he said, I read until I can't see straight. I pray about it. I go to bed. In the middle of the night, I wake up and I understand. He said, I get my understanding in my dreams while I'm asleep. So he always gave the honor and the glory for his knowledge and understanding and insights to the inspiration of the Father, not to his superior brain power. I thought that would
be... that's kind of where we all need to be, is it not, Stephen?
It's where I have to be, because I ain't got that brain power.
Well, I believe that Yahweh has blessed you with a pretty good brain, so that's my personal opinion, so there, take it.
All right. I started... When I first heard the story of King Solomon, that he didn't ask for wealth and power and all the other things that ordinarily people think of in a position of authority like that when he became king, and it compressed Yahweh, who said, okay, you didn't ask for money, you didn't ask for, you know, defeating your enemies, you didn't ask for all these other things that you could have asked for. You asked for wisdom and understanding, and so I'm going to give it to you, but I'm also going to give you all the other things as well. And, you know, to a 5-year-old mind, that really appealed to me, because I saw that I could get, you know, a double blessing if I started praying for wisdom and understanding, I'd also get rich. But I hadn't got rich yet, but I have been able to think things through pretty well. So that's where it comes from.
How do you see these boards of reviews coming together? You know, I've thrown out my ideas on this, and we're kind of proceeding to do this, but... my idea, of course, was to put together an association, a board of review association that would work across these United States, this federation, as you call it, And instead of acting as a Board of Review specifically, it would rather put together a training manual and kind of be representatives of each state coming together to share ideas, and then the idea being that those people working together in a unified way would go back into their states, into their counties, and organize these boards of review. I was really hoping John Darish would be on with us tonight because he's doing exactly what needs to be done, putting people together as grand juries, as common law grand juries. But what they really need to serve as are boards of review so that they're not limited by the authority of a common law grand jury, because for one, it's debatable as to whether or not they can enforce their subpoena power, but also whether or not they can enforce prosecution of anything they determine to be worthy of prosecution. And it certainly limits them on their remedies. So I see this effort that's going on out there. A lot of people are putting a lot of effort out, and we really need to get them to understand the authority and power of the Board of Review so that these efforts will be maximized in their local area. But I see this as being working in conjunction with, for example, recalls. We've had two successful recalls here in Colorado for the first time in its history. And I believe that the reason why they haven't been successful before now is you can find the language right in the Declaration of Independence, and that is that the people weren't hurting bad enough. It was easier for them not to act than it is for them to act. And now the pain of not acting is becoming very apparent to people, so their ears have been healed, as Red says. And now people are willing to really start acting because they're realizing they don't have any choice. If they don't, their freedom is down the tubes. The tyranny is just going to keep right on marching forward. And until the people take a stand, it's not going to change. It's only going to get worse. So
right.
we have a perfect opportunity here. So we need to be putting these efforts together so that we're forming these boards of review, and then the county boards of review can come together with representatives on a state level and carry the weight of multiple counties within their state, and then the states can come together at some point once it gets strong enough that these people are realizing that they do have the power to judge the law, they do have the power to hold these people accountable without waiting for another corrupted election that's not going to change anything. They'll realize that they can actually come together and support one another. I believe that it will certainly embrazen the constitutional county sheriffs if they know that they've got a group of citizens that are going to stand behind them lawfully. And I believe that we can work a revitalization of the well-regulated militia out of these groups, which is needed.
Yeah.
We can push legislation with these groups. We can get sound money going again with these groups. We can do a lot of things with these people if we can just organize at the level. We've seen these assemblies. We've had people assembling all over the country for a number of years now, and they've ended up being somewhat divisive. They didn't know what they could do. They've chased dreams of people that have put ideas out there that they're going to come give them some kind of global settlement. They've taken their money for seminars. They've done all these things. And these people who have assembled could have been putting together boards of review and actually accomplishing something.
Right.
So, this is my vision. My vision is to organize from a multi-state group, but to actually take action at the local level in the counties and in the states. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think philosophically I agree with you. I believe that ultimately our goal should be having a board of review in every county and every state. I don't believe that's realistic at the beginning. I don't believe it's even realistic for the most part right now to do a board of review on a county level. I believe it may be, but generally speaking, my experience tells me that there aren't enough people who are aware of what's going on and are in constant communication with each other on a local level, on a local basis. And so creating a board of review at the state level, to my mind, makes a lot more sense at this point in time. Get one statewide, and when you get enough people involved, then split it up. Take the north half and one take the southern half. Or, if you're in New Hampshire or Vermont, or if you're in North Carolina, where the state is longer than it is tall, we'll take the eastern half and the western half. But ultimately, we'll go divide the country into the four different regions, northeast, southwest, and like that, and then ultimately even go to six, north, central, south, central, like that. And then, as people become aware in their own area of what's being done, then we can establish a board of review at a county level. The other problem with starting at the county level, you basically have to establish the jurisdiction of the board of review that you're creating. Otherwise, it's really nebulous and unclear. So if you set your jurisdiction for the county, then you can't do anything at the state level. If the governor screws up, if the Secretary of State screws up, you don't really have the proper forum established to bring them to task. So I think starting at the state level is essential. There was one other thing. But it escaped me.
Take your mind off of it and it'll come back to you probably.
Yeah, unless I fall asleep.
Well, it's just about that time. You're in the Eastern time zone over there, so it's almost 11 o'clock your time.
Yeah.
So
that has nothing to do with me going to sleep. But
well, we're going to move ahead with this program, and I wish some folks had questions and could call in and ask them here. We've got quite a few listeners tonight.
I did think
would like for them to.
I'm sorry, Terry. I didn't intend on interrupting you like that, but it comes naturally. If somebody has a question, yes, take that. But I did remember what I was going to say regarding the grand juries. The biggest problem, I believe, that the grand jury proponents face is the fact that not only do they have to present their findings almost in the form of a request to the prosecuting attorney, the real problem is not just that the prosecuting attorney works for the corporation. The real problem is the prosecuting attorney is an attorney. And even if he or she responds favorably to their indictment or presentment, it's going to be an invalidated prosecution, ultimately, because the prosecuting attorney is incapable of holding a public office because of the original 13th Amendment. We're going to have to get rid of all of the attorneys that have received a bar affiliation and taken the title of nobility. Everything that every bar-affiliated attorney has done since at least 1815 is going to have to be undone. So that's just another hidden problem with the whole concept of the grand jury approach to remedy and redress.
But this is another thing that a Board of Review could go after.
Exactly.
You know, we look at the civil grand juries in California. I still believe we need to come back and look at that a little bit, because they allow the civil grand jury members in California. It's a unique situation. None of the other states have that law except for Nevada, and they do not use it. So there are no civil grand juries properly seated in any of the other states other than California. But in California, every county has a civil grand jury, and its primary responsibility is government oversight. Now, we've been trying to educate a certain number of people out there so that they realize that they do not have to be limited by the prosecuting attorney or the court that seats them. They have all the full authority of a criminal, what out there they call them criminal grand juries, but a regular seated grand jury like Red was talking about before, and they have full subpoena power. And especially out there where they've got some constitutional sheriffs who are really starting to take a stand. I mean, I saw today that Siskiyou County out there had somebody in the board of whatever they call their county board there. They have issued a request for secession from the state of California. And it looks like several of the counties up in the northern end there are getting together and wanting to form the new state of Jefferson. But the point is that those civil grand juries up there are very similar to what we're talking about doing, and they are put together on a voluntary basis by law. There's no reason why they couldn't act as a Board of Review.
I have a friend up that part of the country, of California. I lost track of him a couple of years ago, but I would love to get in touch with those people.
Well, I believe it's some information we should draw on. We should take a look at that law in particular and see how it relates to Article 61. We're down to the last minute of time. May I ask you to close us in prayer, Stephen?
Certainly. I'd be happy to do that. Father, thank you in the name of Christ Yeshua for your blessings on all of us, for the time to get together to talk about your kingdom, the dominion that we desire for you and your son, Yeshua, to exert over us. We bow before him and before you, our Creator. I ask your blessings on everyone who listened tonight. Thank you for their patience in listening to my froggy voice. I pray that all of the words and the wisdom of our subject matter will penetrate the hearts and minds of your people and all of the American people, that we might restore a righteous government in all of the states of this union. Amen.
Make it so. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Stephen. And Red, thank you for your comments. Kate, thanks for watching that switchboard for us, and we'll see everyone next week on Walls in Our Minds on Thursday evening. But Stephen, you've been a great guest, and I really appreciate you hanging in there with that froggy throat. So,
bless
you this week. All righty.
Thanks.
Have a good night. Good night, everyone. Yeah.